This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Come to town, Rachel.
That is true.
And when did you arrive in Champaign-Urbana?
I arrived the beginning of June, so about a month ago.
And where did you come from?
I came from Detroit, Michigan.
Well, this is an opportunity for people in the Champaign-Urbana community to get to know a new pastor in town. And I'm happy to welcome you on behalf of this local community and, of course, other listeners around the Midwest who are listening to this program might be interested in another Midwesterner, a Lutheran pastor who's chosen to work on campus. Now, I'm going to start off with an odd question, but I warned you I was going to ask if you had any pets.
You did. And that is my favorite topic in all of the world, really, is to talk on and on about my wonderful dog named Rita. And she's a little boxer mix, and some people may have seen me walking around Champaign and be greeted by a very exuberant little dog that looks like a puppy and behaves like a puppy, but unfortunately, or fortunately enough, is not a puppy anymore.
How old is Rita?
She is more than 3 years old, but she has some unsavory puppy habits that have maintained into her regular adulthood of dog.
Now, you've moved to town and brought Rita with you, so you had to find a place to live that would allow a dog. That's not easy sometimes.
No, I was very lucky. I actually just looked at one apartment in Champaign. I was here very quickly and saw it on Craigslist and looked at one apartment and called it good. So
now,
I was lucky.
Now, some pastors, I think maybe this is just Episcopalians and Catholics who have blessing ceremonies for the animals as part of their services once a year.
Actually,
or more?
Lutherans have that too. Lutherans have that too. I'm not sure if it's in necessarily our Lutheran Book of Worship. I doubt it. It's probably not a completely formal liturgy in our book, but there are several Lutheran pastors and congregations that do blessings of pets, and I'd be more than happy to do one. I'm not sure that my dog would take well to the blessing, but we try.
Well, we just had a pet crisis in our extended family.
Oh, no.
I had two of my brothers from out of state visiting this weekend, so there were four of us Shoemaker boys who were hanging around together. And my brother from Iowa City, he and his wife had brought their little Sheltie along, and we shot off some firecrackers out in the country where we live, and the puppy dog just ran into the cornfield. We couldn't find her.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we lost her last night, and so we've all been frantic and putting up posters, but we found her.
That is unbelievable. Someone found her and returned.
They just got him back, so I'm thinking about pets. That's why I started.
That would be a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
That would be a horrible
feeling.
So
why theologically is it important to have these emotional connections with animals?
I have to say, I do think that I have learned so much about the wonder and the mystery of God's love for us through the wonder and the mystery of this strange animal who I can hardly communicate with and who can hardly communicate with me. I think that it does sort of open up your experience and understanding of love and caring for things and responsibility to everyone and every little thing, like a dog.
All things bright and beautiful. That hymn,
that's
is
right.
is that in the Lutheran hymnal?
Oh, of course it is. Yes.
Okay. So I sometimes think that dogs are too loyal. They'll even come back to a master that mistreats them. It's almost like they don't have enough discrimination.
Well, but I think that we're the same way. You know, we are often, not saying that God is the master that we're disloyal to, but there are many friendships or many relationships that we are far too loyal to, that we're somehow trained to receive that unfortunate abuse, and yet we keep coming back for it. And so I think dogs are somehow, unfortunately, similar to us in that way. But it's also amazing that, you know, despite the poor behavior of dogs sometimes, that we keep them.
True.
You know, even though they occasionally bite and scratch or have accidents on the carpet or get sick or cost money, we don't just get rid of them. And if we do, then you're kind of a person that has, you know, is maybe questioned, I think, if you just got rid of your animal because it had an accident or it messed up, you know.
It's interesting that even for animals, we've needed to find social mechanisms, organizations to care for animals when their masters aren't loving and kind and forgiving.
Mm-hmm. And I think those are really wonderful people because those dogs, just like the people who are abused, kind of often manifest really unsavory behavior after being abused for so long. You know, a dog kind of lashes out at people if it's been kicked too much. And those are really special people, I think, who take in those dogs and care for them.
Now you and I here have just been talking about dogs. now, there are cat people, you know. Do you deal with cats?
Cats are not the way of my people, I must say. I don't know cats, and they...
You grew up around dogs?
I grew up around a very cantankerous little Pekingese, and Pekingese tend to be like cats in many ways. They don't really need you. So I'm not sure that I would describe myself as a dog person, but I surely was not a cat person. So they make me sneeze.
So how did you pick a boxer?
I went to the Humane Society, and there was three people in front of me, and they took two dogs, and she was the last one in the hall. And she looked cute enough, and she was the right size and had the right hair or fur. And really, I didn't think about it too much. It's kind of like, you know, I looked at one apartment and I took it. I looked at one dog and I said, she looks right to me.
Now, why were you looking at that point in your life to have a relationship with a dog?
Well, that's a good question. I had bought a house in Detroit and I had a fenced-in backyard, and I think I was looking for a... I am a single person, and so I don't have another entity to have to make decisions on behalf of or to have to take into consideration. I have nothing that I'm necessarily accountable to or responsible for, and I think I was seeking a bit of permanence and seeking a bit of accountability. And so I have this dog that, you know, I have to go on a walk every so often. I have to feed. I have to, you know, recognize every so often. And I think I was looking for a little bit of that that sort of accountability that I think we need.
Sure. Now, you've come to Champaign-Urbana to be the Lutheran campus pastor here for the tell us about your denomination.
Yeah,
there are these four letters that often
the ELCA, yes. And they mean nothing if you don't really know what those are. But it stands for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and the Lutheran Church has several. I'm not sure if factions is the right way to say it, but several denominations that call themselves Lutherans, and so the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America probably is a bit more. To just use a generalized word that doesn't carry a lot of meaning anymore, I don't think, but is probably the more liberal of the Lutheran denominations, if by no other description that they do ordain women, which is obviously how I can be the pastor at such a place. And there are other Lutheran denominations that that are prevalent in the community and also a part of the campus here. But that is the one that we serve, is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which is a large church body across the country. And
is it the largest Lutheran denomination?
It is the largest Lutheran denomination.
What kind of size, roughly?
Oh, goodness, that's a good question that someone who probably had the statistics in front of them would know, but I wrote nothing down on my hands or did not prepare that in any way, so I could not even... Even I'm horrible with
guesstimates.
Well,
one of our listeners may know that answer. So
it'd be wonderful
if
the Lutheran out there would look online and figure out how many congregations there were and baptized members. And I think there's probably lots of people who grew up Lutheran and maybe aren't part of a Lutheran congregation anymore, but they're still on the roster. So it's still a pretty big place. But it's a unique group of people. The headquarters are in Chicago, and so it's all over.
If we do have listeners who would like to ask a question or, in this case, give an answer, do give us a call. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana are 333-9455. That's a local number for folks nearby. If you're farther away, use this toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So if you're listening somewhere where it's a long-distance call to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, do use the 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, or in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Reverend Rachel Bass, who is the pastor of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church, which is the Lutheran Campus Center here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Happy to have people join the conversation. I'm always eager to have other perspectives that we get via telephone here on Keeping the Faith each Sunday between 5 and 6 p.m. Central Time. Rachel, let's talk a little bit more about the Lutheran denomination. As I remember from past conversations with other ELCA folks, this was a denomination that began in Germany. It spread quickly to Scandinavia and did very well in that region. A lot of those folks came to this country, as I recall, and those would be the types who are at least in the history of Lutherans. Of course, I know it's open to anybody and is very, very diverse now.
Well, I think that the diversity needs to be discussed more because there is diversity in it, but sometimes it looks as though it's lacking. Coming from, I just came from the city of Detroit, where not only is the majority of the city African-American, but the majority of the Lutheran churches there are also solidly African-American and have worship in a very traditional African-American style that is also Lutheran. And, you know, they have been Lutheran for generations and generations as well. And so...
And that tends to get overlooked.
It gets very overlooked. And it is assumed that Lutheran also means that you're white and from Minnesota, which is just not the case for everyone.
We have a caller. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, I wanted to ask, you're having been from Detroit and also, I guess, originally in another parish in Orange, California, and this is a strictly student congregation. What sort of challenges do you expect from this congregation that might be different or maybe even the same as others?
Yeah, well, I think that is actually a fantastic question because campus ministry is such a unique... it is such a unique ministry. I think one of the biggest challenges is that in a normal parish, I shouldn't say normal, there is no such thing, but in a traditional parish, you're dealing with whole different generations of people who are sitting in the pew. And so you're trying to speak to a 7-year-old and a 15-year-old and a... Well, there's not many in the way of 20s and 30s in the church. They're all on campus or just not present. But then there are people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and in my last congregation, people in their hundreds. And so trying to make a service that is relevant for all of those people and all of their different educational background and histories is a very different effort than when you're standing facing graduate students and professors and people who are thick in academia. I think that presents a different challenge for me personally. I think also to be a presence on an academic campus where there are so many opportunities for people to expand their mind. And I think that the spiritual dimension of expanding their mind is maybe one of the last places that they think about. And if they are thinking about expanding their mind spiritually, unfortunately, I think probably the church is the last place that they sometimes think of going to expand their mind spiritually. So I think, you know, there are really significant challenges to being a relevant presence on a campus ministry, and the ministry itself is so very different than a traditional ministry. It's hard to even compare.
Caller, did you want to follow up on that?
No, that's fine. I'll just keep listening. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you for the call and the question. Rachel, when you talk about people's need or desire to expand their mind, and often the church is one of the last places they go, or a synagogue or a mosque or whatever, why is that? Why is it that when young people are exploring, they often don't look at some of the obvious places?
Well, I think that there's a lot of people who, you know, I myself kind of consider myself in the genre of young people.
How old are you?
I am 33. Okay. And I think that many of us grew up in the church, in a traditional church and congregation, and we went to Sunday school and confirmation, and many of us were not really shocked by any of it. You know, it was sort of, you know, it didn't expand our minds a ton, or at least we didn't think it was expanding our minds. It was just kind of filling our minds. And when we got to college, it was sort of, we were free to fill our minds with whatever we wanted to. And we already knew what the church had to say. And it didn't seem like the church was saying anything new. And so if you're expanding your mind, why go to what you've already heard 1,000 times?
Sure.
And it wasn't satisfactory the first time you heard the story of, you know, the Good Samaritan, or whatever story that, you know, people didn't really hear a satisfactory interpretation of God. Or maybe it wasn't an integrous message with the way people were living and the way people were talking. I think that many young folks get offended by the church and don't see it as a place to expand their mind, and don't see it as a place to be that they can authentically challenge and grow. I think there are lots of other places that they find that space to challenge and space to challenge their own minds.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. I was raised a Methodist, actually.
Where?
In Wisconsin, just outside of Madison. So I was raised in red as a badger. And my blood will always run red, but I'm trying to incorporate some orange into my life. But I was raised a Methodist, and just really by accident stumbled upon Valparaiso University, which is a very strong Lutheran college, school.
What appealed to you about Valpo?
You know, I think I really did want to go to a private faith-based school, but I didn't necessarily, I had no intentions of becoming a pastor. I had no expectations of much religious involvement, but I did want a sort of what I perceived to be a well-rounded education. My older brother had gone to St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, and had a really outstanding experience there, and I saw that and was pretty inspired by it, and so I think I hoped for the same in Valparaiso, and I don't think I was let down either. It was a really wonderful place to grow and challenge and be challenged, and a space to grow up.
When you think back about your college days, since you're going to be working largely with college students here on this campus, who were some of the people that made an impact on you, and why?
That's a good question. Who are some of the people that made an impact on me during college? Well, when I was my sophomore year in college, I oddly went to Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for one semester. And while I was there, I took a class from a Southern Baptist pastor at this large Catholic institution, and it was a class on liberation theology. And so I was learning all about the work of priests in Latin America and the amazing things that they had intended to do there and tried and were still about. And it was from this very strange and wonderfully loving pastor as well. And that was a really provocative time for me. And I was also very moved and inspired by many of the priests and the nuns actually at Marquette and their faithful lifestyle. And so I sought out other experiences. I worked at a Lutheran camp during the summers that had a very strong social justice focus. And it really taught it taught a certain Christian lifestyle of simplicity, of thoughtful consumption, of environmental stewardship and community action and community involvement and community responsibility. And so there were several people who by their lifestyle, their intentional and thoughtful and conscientious lifestyle that really inspired me during college. And they were people of faith, whether they were pastors or not, but they were people of faith. And that was a really significant decision for me.
We have another caller who's waiting, and let me encourage other listeners to give us a call in Champaign-Urbana. There are several local lines you can reach by punching in 333-9455. If you're outside Champaign-Urbana, do use the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Line number one, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm calling because I realize that the evangelical faith has been a hard-won position. I wonder what has been the hardest challenge for the guest speaker, because I know she just arrived, and I know she in her room, and how old she is. Anyhow, welcome, Rachel. I hope your experience so far has been very good. I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Thank you so much. And I think your question was about the development of the Lutheran Church or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I'm not exactly sure. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still.
Can you restate your question? I'm not sure that I understand what you were asking.
My question is, the Evangelical Church has allowed women to be ordained for a long time, I think. Can you give the history of that, and has it been difficult for you?
Has it been difficult for you as a woman since the Lutheran Church, the ELC, has sort of taken the lead encouraging women to be part of the pastoral ministry? Has it been difficult for you, or were you accepted, or was?
Well, what I think is interesting for myself, I guess, is I grew up in the United Methodist Church, and I grew up with a female pastor.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
And it was a husband and wife team, and the wife was the lead pastor, and the husband did the visitation, and he did the more pastoral care side of ministry. And somehow, I don't know if I missed all of the debate, but it never crossed my mind that a woman could not be a pastor. At the time, when I was a kid, I just wondered why anyone would want to be a pastor. I honestly don't remember being told or having that notion come in my mind that a woman couldn't be a pastor. And so I think I come from maybe a young enough generation. And because I also didn't grow up in the Lutheran Church, part of those stories that make up our present reality and the retelling of those stories and the retelling of the difficulty that women had in receiving calls and being accepted by congregations or by the larger church body, those stories are not, they were not part of my childhood. And the fact that we had a female pastor was never questioned to me, and it wasn't a part of the environment that I grew up in. And so it hasn't been difficult for me because I just have never really perceived for myself. I have never had to have that same struggle. But I also, in saying that, recognize that I am unique in that way and that there are many, many women who have had to struggle and have had to really seek out that respect that wasn't easy and did feel the great tension and did feel the enormous scandal that it was. But as for me personally, that has not been my experience, and I know that I am blessed and lucky that I didn't know.
What about at seminary? Did you go directly from Valparaiso University after you graduated into seminary, or did you do something else first?
I did. I did something else. After seminary, I was a part of in the Lutheran Church. There are organizations where it's called the Urban Servant Corps, and it was a year of service and community living in Denver, Colorado. And so I lived with 11 other housemates in a house in downtown Denver, which at the time was a rough neighborhood, but now it is pretty much a palatial superstar location. But and I led youth groups on experiential learning, Lutheran youth groups on experiential learning through Denver. And so we went to the Capitol and spoke with Lutheran advocacy, and we went to homeless shelters and discussed poverty, and we went to, we went all over and discussed issues of faith and justice and community life. And so I did that for a year, and then I traveled and visited a friend who is in the Peace Corps in Malawi, Africa, for several months. And so about 2 years after I graduated from college, I went to seminary in Chicago at the Lutheran School of Theology there. Which is one of our denomination's seminaries. I think there's 8 seminaries across the country for the ELCA. And so I went to the one in Chicago that is just across the street from the University of Chicago in Hyde Park.
And when you were at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, what was the proportion of women to men who were there studying to be pastors?
You know, I'm not sure what the ratio is, but I'm pretty sure it is nearly 50-50. So there was lots and lots of females who were there with me, and there, you know, some women were seeking to be a lay leader in the church, a rostered lay leader, and most I would say were looking to be ordained in the church as well. So and there wasn't. And again, I might just be blind to it, and I'm sure that other people had very different experiences, but I did not experience in that place a feeling of being held back as a woman.
Were there strong women faculty at the seminary?
There was not. I will say there was a few women faculty, but that is an area that is sorely lacking. But it was also changing just as I was leaving. Several women professors had been hired just as I was leaving, but there wasn't many present. And I would say that's probably true across the board, that there aren't as many women in seminaries as there maybe needs to be.
We're talking about Keeping the Faith today with Reverend Rachel Bass, who is the new pastor, just here 1 month at the St. Andrews Lutheran Church and director of the Lutheran Campus Ministry here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the director of the University YMCA and the host for these Keeping the Faith programs most of the time, although this last month my wife and I were fortunate to be able to be gone for 3 weeks on a fascinating trip to Turkey and to Israel and Palestine. And we want to thank Don Nolan for filling in as host some of those Sundays while I was gone. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, next week, Diane Hatch will be our guest on July 15, talking about composing a worship service. She's particularly noted for her abilities at combining music and words and other things with different themes from Scripture. And we'll be talking with Diane about that on July 15 here on Keeping the Faith. July 22nd, our guest will be Elihu Smith, who is the director of the Zen Buddhist Center in Champaign. And he'll be talking about a recent pilgrimage he took to China and talking about the Zen Buddhist practice there today. So that'll be July 22nd here on Keeping the Faith. On July 29, we'll have another Lutheran, a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor, Rick Miles, whose congregation is right next door to
Rachel Bass.
So,
it's a Lutheran stronghold.
It is. So we'll talk about some of the differences between Lutherans, and specifically talk about the campus ministry of the Missouri Synod branch on July 29. August 5th, Rafe Melhado will be our guest, talking about his recent study for a year, Jewish studies in Israel. So those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Hope you'll be able to listen and perhaps give us a call. You might jot down these phone numbers in case you have a question for our guest. This is a live program most weeks, and we're eager to have you make a comment or ask a question. Anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may be listening to this at WILL.UIUC.EDU, where you can also hear archives of our programs if you've missed a part of one or one completely and would like to see that. If you have access to a computer, it's easily found at that website, and you may be listening live to this program. It is streamed there each week. So if you're listening in the continental U.S., you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. To ask a question or make a comment. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several lines, 333-9455. I mentioned I was the director of the YMCA. The Y is the sponsor of this program, and the Y is the oldest charity in Champaign County. We've been in this county for 134 years on this campus and in the community. This Y does not have a pool or a gym or a fitness center, but rather it's a way for university people, students mainly, but also faculty and staff to be involved in community service, to be involved in social action, and various educational components. We have speakers that we bring into campus and the community each semester, and we'll be talking more about that as we get closer to September. One of our big projects over the summer is called Dump and Run, and regular listeners know we collect things that students leave behind when they take off in the spring, when they graduate or go home for the summer and don't have room to take everything with them. We also collect things over the summer, and our next collection will be starting in August, August 14 to 21. At the Stock Pavilion out on Pennsylvania Avenue. So if you have household goods, things that students might like in setting up apartments, things for their dorm rooms, particularly international students, we'll be having a couple thousand new international students show up on this campus in the fall, and we have a great welcome reception for them at the Y. But we also know that they'll be desperate for inexpensive furniture and kitchenware and anything for an apartment. If you have those items, do bring them to the Stock Pavilion between August 14 and 21st. Then we'll have our great sale August 23rd, 24th, and 25th. And many people in the community also find that a way to get some bargains, and it's a lot of fun. So let's get back to our guest today. We're talking with Rachel Bass. Rachel, we were talking about your experience in seminary. Let me ask you the same question about seminary I asked about college. Who particularly had an impact on you now that you've been a pastor for a while? As you look back on those formative years, who do you particularly remember positively?
I would say that without a doubt, my seminary time, what I learned most was working actually in an international student affairs office. I was the student assistant to a woman named Inga Lemp, who was the daughter of Lutheran professors at a seminary in East Timor. She grew up there, and she was very, very active in the East Timorese issues. At that time, were really quite violent. If you remember, there was a horrible massacre and elections, and she was in Chicago, but she was very, very active as a leader in advocacy there, and was really just an incredible example of a life of hospitality to everyone that she met in a sort of radically Christian way that was unmatched by anyone that I knew. And so I, from her, I learned that that hospitality goes a long way. And the generosity of love and welcome and acceptance of seeking people out who are, or maybe not even seeking them out too much, but if you're hospitable, it seems that you find people. You sort of magnetize yourself to them. And it was a really powerful learning experience to be a student among the international community, which was mostly families that had come there to get their, for the man usually to get the, his PhD. And so to be a part of their life and hear their stories of faith was very, very powerful for me at the time to also integrate with what I was learning from a very traditional, very traditional white male theological education.
Sure.
To have this whole world, and especially I was especially involved with the spouses of these students, and so I led an international women's Bible study there, and it was very much a group led. I should barely say that I led it. It just means that I made the coffee. But and just learned so much and had such a exceptional resource of integrating what I was learning and questioning and an ability to sort of counter what I was learning in this, what was a very traditional white male theological perspective and sort of holding that up with these other models of faith and ways of being church and ways of even reading the scripture was so different with these women from Burma and Madagascar and Brazil, you know, to hear them read the scripture and to say what stood out for them, it turned everything on its head. And so to have both of those educations simultaneously was just rich for me.
You mentioned that before you went to seminary, you'd had an experience visiting one of the poorest countries in the world, Malawi, in Africa. You said you went there to see a friend, but were you also curious about what that part of the world was like?
Well, yeah, I had a dear friend from college who was in the Peace Corps there, and Madonna was not there yet. I honestly don't think I even really knew where Malawi was until she got assigned to go there. And, I did not travel abroad in college because it just seemed like a lot of money and people just seemed to go and, you know, go to Ireland and sort of like drink their education away. It seemed from the stories that I heard and I just... For whatever reason, I never did that, and this seemed like a wonderful opportunity to really see someplace, to live with someone who is actually living in a village, and you know, when would you get an opportunity to go to an African country, and myself as a single woman, that I could go there by myself and meet her there, and I was there for a little more than 2 months. And looking back, I am shocked at myself that I just sort of decided that I was going to go to Malawi for a little more than 2 months, but used her and the other Peace Corps volunteers as sort of my resources. And Malawi's a very small country, but I just sort of traveled up and down this country visiting Peace Corps volunteers. I should have been contracted by the Peace Corps to do interviews of these these people, but it was really an outstanding experience it's hard to even put into words what a rich experience that was to go and be a part and to be in some major cities and you know, it was also a unique experience that Malawi at the time, you know, Madonna had not discovered Malawi, and there are not a lot of visitors. There's not tourists to Malawi. I think there's some pot that's fairly famous in Malawi, but I think probably every country has its famous pot that travel that people are willing to travel for. But there wasn't tourists there, and I could pass as a Peace Corps volunteer, so I didn't look like a tourist either, and I wasn't going to touristy areas that actually there are in Malawi, and so it was a unique opportunity to sort of. You know, obviously I stood out as a young white woman, but it was a really unique opportunity to meet people and go to churches and go to public elementary schools and health stations and all the different varieties of Peace Corps volunteers in that country and see, a unique side of a country. So.
We've had guests on this show several times in the past who have been involved in various things in Malawi. The Marian Medical Mission that Tom and Jocelyn Logan have headed up for years have been building shallow wells to provide clean drinking water for the various villages in Malawi, and they've been on this program a couple times. And that same project has been supported by a local Rotary Club, the Urbana Rotary Club here. Has also been providing money to provide wells for some of those villages in Malawi.
So it's not just Madonna supporting.
Well,
Malawi, huh?
it's a small country, but it happens there are some local connections as well.
That's great.
Tell us where you went after seminary before you came to Champaign-Urbana.
Well, I did my internship in San Bernardino, California, which is kind of the festering wound in Southern California. It's a very, very poor place, and lots of undocumented, mostly Mexican families that are there live in very subsistence, substandard living, and it was a very non-traditional Lutheran entity that owned probably 25 homes and rebuilt them, abandoned homes and rebuilt them, and were housing people who were HIV positive and otherwise homeless in them, and gave them mental and medical and nutritional care. And we started a worship service in Spanish. And
do you speak Spanish?
I do. I haven't spoken it for several years, so now is not the time for someone to call and just start speaking Spanish. But if you wanted to, well, it could be a fun game. But at the time, I did become fluent in Spanish at the time. But it was a really unique, very non-traditional Lutheran community that's horrible to say that it's non-traditionally Lutheran, but it was truly a church of the poor. By the poor, for the poor. And it was a remarkable place to learn. And so that was a very formative time.
How long were you there?
Just for a year.
1 year.
But it was kind of an experience that turns you inside out and shakes you upside down and then sets you back straight again, and you're never quite the same.
Now, was that internship in the middle of your seminary or at the end of it?
It was the third year of my seminary, so I went back to Chicago.
So you had a total of 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yep. And then, oddly enough, after Chicago, I went to Southern Orange County, California, in a place called Rancho Santa Margarita. And it is literally on the other side of the mountain from San Bernardino, and it is a extremely wealthy, extremely, extremely wealthy area of Orange County, which is a very wealthy place to begin with. And was there for a little less than 2 years.
What was your position there?
I was the associate pastor.
This is a large church with several pastors?
It was a large enough church to have two pastors. What was so large was the youth. It was a very young area, and this is the area where Rick Warren and Saddleback, it was in the Saddleback Mountains. And so the Saddleback Church and the purpose-driven life was sort of the book that people just carried around in their back pocket at all times. And Rick Warren was kind of the mayor of town, and I could see his gigantic campus from the pulpit. And so it was a really unique area as far as faith goes.
And what did you conclude about that way of understanding the Christian faith from having seen it up close?
Well, I have to confess, I'm a little embarrassed to say that I actually never went to Saddleback for a church service or a Bible study, and there was a billion opportunities, I'm sure, to go, but I guess I was busy doing other things. But, you know, I have a hard time critiquing what he does too much. It is a totally different way of making church than we do in the Lutheran church. But he reaches a lot of people. And I also have read some recent magazine articles or, you know, kind of general media that is speaking about the work that he is attempting to do in Africa and other countries or around the world, excuse me, in reaching out, which, you know, sort of in my experience, the larger, those mega church evangelical places, that's not the first thing I would think of, is that they're sort of training people to do the justice work, to do the service work. But I really think that he is trying to make a difference in that way. I do. And so there are maybe some theological differences and some differences in approach, but he is definitely starting out with people who are new to the faith. Because, and out there, you know, not everybody grew up anything. There's a lot of people out there who didn't grow up in the church at all. And so their first experience with church is Rick Warren and Saddleback community. And you are brought into a community of faith immediately. It's really an unbelievable system where you come into a church that maybe has, you know, 10,000 people in the room, but you know intimately 25 people because of the small group that you're a part of.
Sure.
So it's not this overwhelming experience. And he's starting at a different place as far as teaching faith. He's starting at an introduction as opposed to, I think, the Lutheran Church, for better or for worse, starts with an assumption that you grew up knowing what's what. And it doesn't start from the beginning of understanding faith. It starts from some assumed knowledge, and I don't think he assumes knowledge.
Now, you said that looking at these mega churches, these evangelical mega churches, you don't assume they're going to be very much involved in social action or working for justice issues. And you use that adjective evangelical, but that same word evangelical is in your denomination, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America.
It is.
How is that word different the way it's used that way?
Well, I think it's sort of like the cultural meaning that that we've put on it and that I'm using. So, you know, the strict term of evangelical is, you know, spreading the good news of Jesus Christ. And so that is the attempt of the Lutheran Church as well. And so that is why it should be called Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And I guess I use the describe a Saddleback church or a, I can't remember the name of the gigantic
Willow Creek.
Willow Creek,
yeah.
As evangelical in a broader descriptive way. And it's a different, that's one of the pickles, I think, of the use of that word and many of our words that we use, because it does indeed say Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, but I would not, unfortunately, that is in our strongest suit, is going beyond ourself or really teaching people from where they are. And I think that is, you know, a fine point, a fine quality of some of these larger churches that really start from teaching people at the very beginning.
Now, after 2 years as an associate pastor in Orange County, you were working mainly with the youth, it sounds like.
I was, yeah. I was working mostly with the youth. And actually, when I left, I suggested that they didn't hire another pastor, but they hire a youth director.
Oh, uh-huh.
Because that's what they really needed. And so,
where did you go then?
Then I went to the far northeast side of Detroit, the booming near ghost town that it is, it seems like. People are moving out of Detroit as fast as they can, and foreclosures are very high. It's a tough place to be, but I was in a fairly stable neighborhood at the time. It, like any part in the area now, in Metro Detroit, is full of houses that are empty and for sale. But truly, the neighborhood that I was in was fairly stable. Working class.
You were a solo pastor there?
I was a solo pastor of a a very small congregation in an enormous, beautiful building that at one time had been, you know, the great church in the neighborhood. When all the white middle class workers lived in that neighborhood, they all went to that church. And
who was there when you went, and when did you go?
I was there for the last about 3 years, and the neighborhood was almost entirely African American, working class, and in Detroit, you know, having a job is a rather tenuous situation. It's never certain for anyone, but for the most part, it was a working class neighborhood, young families. But now the congregation is mostly elderly, white women, mostly, who a few lived in the neighborhood, but mostly they lived quite far out, which is kind of the trend of Detroit. It is a very, very segregated city area.
So were there any African-American or Hispanic members of the church?
There was not. You know, we were trying to build up some community fellowship and community opportunity around that congregation, because I honestly didn't have much expectation that a young African-American family would walk into this sanctuary full of 95-year-old women and in a gigantic sanctuary with very, very traditional Lutheran hymns, very old traditional Lutheran hymns. And I had very little expectation that a young African-American family would feel welcome or really feel like this was their church. But at the same time, these old 95-year-old ladies needed to have a church too.
Sure.
And so the real attempt was to build up a system around and build up a community around that worshiping congregation, which eventually would literally pass away, so that this community that had built up around it would sort of become the congregation in effect. So that was the hope, and I feel good about the work that I did there, and it was the time to go.
And why now campus ministry? What appeals to you about this?
Well, you know, I hadn't necessarily sought it out, I must admit. I wasn't thinking about it. Campus ministry was sort of a thing that I understood. You didn't get to pick. And if you did say, I want to do campus ministry, it meant you surely never got to do it.
Really?
And at least in as I understood in the Lutheran Church, that there's so many people, so many congregations that need pastors that they're not likely to give them up to campus ministries or to anything that is not a traditional parish. And but I got a letter in the mail that said I had been recommended for campus ministry, and I put it off for about 2 years while I was in Detroit getting that done. And then there just kind of came a time where I realized that I had done what I had been asked to do in Detroit and was pleased with myself and had long enough had felt like God was, you know, sticking the divine finger in my ear, poking me and saying, hey, lady, look over there. And so I did. I looked over here in Champaign-Urbana, and the challenge of having the church be something that speaks to young, intelligent people is an exciting challenge to me, that we can't just do the same things again and again and again, hoping for different results, because the young people have, for the most part, left the church. And so how do we be a voice that will be heard? And that is, and as a young person myself, I think that's a valid question, because I did hear the church, and it was a voice that spoke to me and inspired me. And I think that there are others who are seeking to be inspired.
Now you're a well-educated young woman with a graduate degree, and you talk about yet hearing a voice from God telling you to do something. I mean, you've studied psychology. How do you know this isn't your imagination? Something deep
within
you.
Well, it is sort of a divine imagination that I think is a gift from God in and of itself. And I don't think it's crazy at all. I think that we all have to trust ourselves and that the reflection that comes through my mind that I can hardly articulate, that I think everyone experiences, whether they profess a faith or not, they have this sort of internal interpretation of the world around them and their life. And I think that's a gift from God. And I trust it. I listen and I question it and challenge it and keep listening. And I don't think it just all comes inside my head. It comes from other people around me, and it comes from what I read, what I see.
Are there any constraints on it? Like some of our listeners are sitting there thinking, yeah, some people have thought they heard the word of God to go kill Muslims.
Yeah, that's when you have to question yourself. And I think that there's great value in having a hair of suspicion of your own creative imagination, of your own divine word, that you have to be a bit suspicious, that you don't just assume that every thought that passes your head or every, you know, little whisper that you think is from God, don't assume that it is, because it could be far from it. And so there is some suspicion needed.
We have a caller on line number one. Will you have just a minute? Go quickly.
Yes, I'll go very quickly. I called earlier. How do you know when you're bloom or you're planting? And that's my question. How do you know if you're bloom where you're planted?
How do you know where you are is where you're supposed to bloom and grow and develop, or whether you should move?
Well, I have moved a lot in the past 10 years, and so I say, you know, if the wind picks up that little seed and the petal and the tries to plant it somewhere else, bloom there too. I say there is no sake in waiting to bloom. Just bloom. Go ahead. Don't hold back. If you are a seed, you are born to be blooming. So wait it out, and when it's ready to bloom, it'll happen. You don't have to be the one to say, no, this isn't the place to bloom. We need you to bloom.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Reverend Rachel Bass, B-A-S-S. And Rachel, you spell your first name R-A-C-H-E-L.
Yes,
so
I do.
Our listeners will know. She's the new pastor at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church on the campus of the University of Illinois. When is your regular worship service on Sundays?
It's at 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
And there is some discussion that starting in the fall we'd be at 11, but that is not set in stone by any means.
So St. Andrew's currently is meeting at 10 o'clock on the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street in Champaign, and you're open for visitors, I'm sure.
All the time.
I want to thank Rachel for being our guest today. She's just come to town, been here only a month, so we're happy to have had her on Keeping the Faith. Next week, we'll be talking with Dan Hatch about composing a worship service. The following week, July 22nd, with Elihu Smith about Zen Buddhist practice in China today. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
They say his stare could drive you crazy. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the greatest chess player ever, Garry Kasparov. His most famous opponent was the IBM supercomputer Deep Blue. Kasparov shocked the chess world recently when he suddenly retired from chess and went into politics in his native Russia. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
I'm station manager Jay Pierce. We won't have final results to report until later this month, but I want to thank you right away for what you and your Central Illinois neighbors have accomplished. 12,500 individuals, families, and businesses contributed about $1.9 million to support WILL. This generosity enables us to provide you with a new year of programs and services. Experience what community-supported public media has to offer. Thank you.
AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.